Good afternoon. My name is John Palfrey. I'm Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and delighted to welcome you all here from near and far to an event as part of the Berkman Center's 10th anniversary celebration, Berkman at 10. We hope very much that those of you who are here will all come back to this room on May the 15th and 16th to celebrate with us our 10th anniversary. This event, where we get to welcome back an old and close friend, is part of a series leading up to this celebration in May, and we very much encourage you to keep with the conversation after tonight. Also on logistics, we are, after this event, going down to the rotunda just below this room for a reception at about 6:30 or 6:45, and hope that you will all stay and join us for a drink as well, and to congratulate and welcome Professor Lessig on his new efforts. So by way of introduction, I suspect most of you know a great deal about Professor Lessig. It's why this room is full on a late Friday afternoon on a rainy day here in Cambridge. But to us, he was the first Berkman Professor of Law. He was here at the beginning of the Berkman Center a decade ago. It was here that he wrote Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace and had a book party that energized many of us to make this our field and our life's commitment in lots of respects. It was here that he began Creative Commons around a conference room, conference table at the Berkman Center in its first home, which has turned out to be an extraordinary experiment and player in the world of intellectual property. And it was here that he initiated the Eldred versus Ashcroft litigation, which in many ways was one of the key events in the development of the cyber law field. He left us, unfortunately, for Stanford. Perhaps it was better weather, which he refused to bring back with him tonight. But it was at Stanford that he made each of these things into what they've become today. Creative Commons went with him to the West Coast. We regretted that in a way at the time, but it was obviously the right home because it was from there that he created not just a field of cyber law, but in fact a movement of which many of us have become partisans and which I think bring many of you here today. It was also at Stanford that he wrote The Future of Ideas and also Free Culture, the book that has spawned a group on many campuses to come together and to fight for a future that includes much more freedom for all of us in our means of expression. It's also the moment at which the Eldred versus Ashcroft litigation, in a loss, became a great win and something that galvanized many to action. For those of you who are not yet part of the pre-culture movement, I hope you will become part of it. Tim Huang and Diana Kimball and others have a sign-up sheet outside, and on your way out, I hope you will join them as part of free culture. But it's not about either of the Creative Commons movement nor free culture that Lawrence Lessig returns to us today as part of Berkman at 10. 10 years into the cyber law field that he created, he has moved on to something else and is taking on a yet greater challenge for which we ought to be very grateful. He's taking his rock star status in our field and his virtuoso PowerPoint performances to reform the institution of Congress. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome Lawrence Lessig back to the Berkman Center and to Harvard Law School and to tell us about what he's going to do over the next decade, we hope, to reform this institution, the U.S. Congress, and to bring us all along with him. Professor Lessig, thank you for coming home.
So, one of the many things I forgot to pack this morning was the California weather. And so rather than bringing the weather, I thought I would start with some California stories. For of course, today at least, California is my home. It's my home for now. And there's something special about the place that I think explains what we want to do next. So here are the stories. First, a story about some actors. 43 years ago, Governor of California, an actor, sorry, not that one, but this one, gave a radio address in which he talked about democracy. This is what he said. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy. Very depressing image, collapsing democracy. That was Reagan's inspiration, fighting that collapse. That's the actors. Now some teachers. University of California, San Francisco, there's a professor and doctor, Drummond Rennie. He was the deputy editor of the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the AMA. And he's become focused on what we should think of as a problem of corruption in the field of medicine and medical research. But to understand that corruption, you need to step back a little bit, think a little bit about this industry, the drug industry. 2005, the prescription drug industry was about a $200 billion industry. In the same year, pharmaceutical companies spent about $16 billion promoting prescription drugs. We have to keep that in context. We may hit $1 billion in this presidential election season. They spend $16 billion 8 years ago promoting drugs. Almost $5 billion of that is for something called detailing. Detailing is this process of sending people out to doctors to get them to adopt particular drugs. Now, there are a lot of doctors, and there are a lot more detailers. Between 1995 and 2005, there went from about 38,000 drug representatives to about 100,000 drug representatives. There's now about 2.5 doctors for every drug representative. And what they do is they go out and give samples and gifts to doctors as a way to get them to change their prescribing choices. As one detailer described it, the essence of pharmaceutical gifting is bribes that aren't considered bribes. And in one very candid interview, he said, "While the doctor's job is to treat patients and not to justify their actions, it's my job to constantly sway the doctor. It's a job. I'm paid and trained to do it. Doctors are neither trained nor paid to negotiate. Most of the time, they don't even realize that's what they're doing." Now, this problem is actually small potatoes. There, look, small potatoes to the problem I really want to focus on here, which is the problem of research, research in the context of basic science. And this is where Drummond Remy's work has been so extraordinarily important. Beginning to demonstrate not so much the corruption of people making up data or buying results, but what he describes, quote, "the massive bias and distortion of the published evidence by researchers and their sponsors, both influenced by money." As he concludes this study, first, it was found that companies paying physician scientists to publish the same results of the same trials in different journals under different authors' names with no cross-referencing. They were getting the results of their sponsors wanted in drug trials by hobbling the other horse in the race, the competitor's drug, which the trials were administered in the wrong dose by the wrong route. And then offering tens of thousands of dollars simply to add their own names to reviews of a drug's efficacy, reviews they had never seen before and which were always favorable to the new drug. Now, this strategy among many produces a very important result. And in the context of medicine, we can actually measure this result because we can begin to do comparative studies of the results of pharmaceutical drugs and see which types of studies produce reliable results. Rennie's point is the result of this process is to produce a whole bunch of false science. As he describes, in every one of the many scores of such studies of published trials, an overwhelming bias was found in favor of the sponsors' drugs, a bias that was not present when the trials were performed by investigators free of commercial funding. This is, as Rennie teaches, a kind of corruption, a corruption of science, a corruption that directly affects one of the most important scientific fields for all of us. That's the story of teachers. Now, of course, living in a state like California, it's great to have so many actors around, great to have some great teachers around, but the most extraordinary part of California is, of course, the geeks. The geeks, who are these extraordinarily brilliant people working on literally the hardest problems that there are out there to solve. I mean, think about, for example, the works of the geeks at a company like Intel, who spend their life focused on the question of how to take tiny, tiny devices and make them even smaller, and in this process, arguing with God about what the laws of nature really require. Arguing to make stuff work, which other people would have said was impossible. They want to take the impossible and make it possible. Now, when you look at the work of geeks, though, there's something very puzzling about what they do. What you could think of as unchallenged impossibilities in their life. Things which they think are impossible and they refuse to try to do anything about. So, for example, I was invited just once to a conference sponsored by Microsoft. This was a conference about email and spam. And it gathered together these amazing geeks who were there to demonstrate their amazing code, as in software, for the purpose of filtering and blocking spam. And so they were describing fantastic advances in Bayesian filters, promising 98%+ success in their work. But what was amazing about all of these descriptions of technologies to, quote, solve the problem of spam, was that nowhere in the description of any of these people was the word law uttered. I mean, not law as some kind of silver bullet, but law as at least one tool, a comparable tool, that might, you know, on the margin, improve the success of any particular solution by 1 or 2%. Right? To take this impossible problem and make it just 1 or 2% better in conjunction with these other technologies. And so I was sitting there as a law professor watching this conference go on, watching the omission of the part that is the center to my life, I had the temerity to stand up and ask about this omission. And as I looked around at the audience, the basic reaction was something like this. Quickly followed up with a reaction something like this. Because the reaction of the geeks was that it was absolutely ridiculous, just ridiculous, to suggest that there was a place for law in solving this public policy problem. And by even suggesting it, I had disqualified myself as a geek, even a geek wannabe. The idea that I would code with government, code with law, was as ridiculous as if I had offered my latest basic program to the geeks here to demonstrate how cool I really was. Okay, so that's about the geeks. That's the end of the story. Here's the argument I want you to see. So the question I want to start with is a question about those geeks. It's a question about whether those geeks are right. Are they, in fact, justified in their skepticism about the place of law? Is it, in fact, as hopeless as they think? Is government as hopeless as they think? Or more geek-like in the frankness of the question, is the government just stupid? Now, of course, there's lots of evidence that the government's pretty stupid. Government gets it wrong all the time. I'm not talking about hard cases. We understand how people get hard cases wrong. I'm talking about easy cases. Easy cases the government gets wrong. And maybe it's the easy cases that's the best evidence of just how, quote, stupid this government might be. So for example, think about one easy case that got born here at the Harvard Law School, a case around the question of copyright term. It's a consensus among public policymakers, or at least who think about public policy, that any copyright term change should be prospective only. It could make no sense from the perspective of the purpose of copyright to extend the term of an existing copyright. In England, the Gowers Commission, headed by a former editor of the FT, reviewed all the economic evidence and concluded it could never make sense to extend the term of existing copyright. When we brought the case to the Supreme Court and had a brief signed by 13 economists, including 5 Nobel Prize winners, including Ronald Coase and Milton Friedman, Milton Friedman said he would only join the brief if the word no-brainer existed in the brief somewhere. So public policymakers acknowledge that always you should limit an extension of copyrights to prospective extensions, but governments always extend the term of existing copyrights whenever they extend the term prospectively. So Germany extended it first, leading the EU to then extend it, leading the United States to extend it, but we went a little bit further than the EU, so now the EU is extending it again, leading Spain to extend it above the EU, and the cycle never ends. Plain, easy case, which the government gets wrong. Here's another example, nutrition. There's a consensus among people who know something about nutrition that we eat too much of this junk and not enough of this stuff. So in 2003, the World Health Organization decided they'd try to change this a little bit by setting up some standards about how much of each of these things we should eat. And they set up a rule that said that no more than 10% of your daily caloric intake should come from sugars. Well, the sugar industry, they have this very sweet little symbol to symbolize them, basically went ballistic. There they are, going ballistic. And they took action to get the government to basically threaten to withdraw funding from the WHO if the WHO didn't back down from this recommendation. Here's a letter signed by Senator Craig threatening in this context the WHO for its outrageous decision to try to reduce the amount of sugar intake that people had. The WHO should adopt, the government of the United States suggested, urged on by the sugar industry, a rule that says 25% of your daily caloric intake should be coming from sugar. So in 2003, the Food Nutrition Board, our government's board, promulgated recommendations of 25%. Intake coming from sugar. This is a balanced diet, according to our government. And indeed, this is what you can eat, according to our government, and live a healthy life. You could start with some Fruit Loops for breakfast, or M&Ms, a glass of milk. For lunch, you can have a cheeseburger. For dinner, you can have a pizza, actually 3 slices of pepperoni pizza, and some sugar cookies. That's a balanced diet, according to our government. Here again, an easy public policy case that we just get fundamentally wrong. It may be most important, certainly most important. Think about global warming. Obviously, this is an issue which has taken center stage in public policy debates right now, but it's not just recently that scientists have recognized what the problem here is. Indeed, there's a consensus that we're doing it. As Al Gore describes the consensus, the debate is over. There are 5 points in this consensus. Number 1, global warming is real. Number 2, we human beings are mainly responsible. Number 3, consequences are very bad. Number 4, we need to fix it quickly. And number 5, it's not too late. Now, as a way to measure whether Gore's claim about the consensus was true, there was a study made of 1,000 peer-reviewed articles about climate change between 1993 and 2003. 0%, exactly 0, questioned the basic assumptions of the Gore consensus. And then at a roughly similar period of time, there was a study of 600 popular media articles about global warming between 1988 and 2002. 53% of those articles questioned the basic assumptions about global warming. And that question was the product of junk science funded by the interests that were interested in stopping people from recognizing the danger of global warming, delaying the United States government from actually addressing this question for at least 10 years. Here again, an easy public policy question which we've gotten wrong. Now, in all 3 of these cases, these easy cases which we get wrong, this is motivation for sane people,
including some insane people, to be justifiably disdainful of the United States government's ability to deal with these questions. Here is the image of disdainfulness, right? Leading many geeks to this kind of hopeless position, and indeed leading many of them to then adopt an attitude which there's nothing to do with this government. Indeed, in the district which I was being urged by many people back here to run for Congress in, less than a third of Democrats actually go out and vote in an election like a primary that would be deciding the next congressman. Because most of them, most in this area, think government is simply a waste of time. Now, is it? Is the government hopeless? Or let's start with a simpler question. Is the government stupid? My view is the answer to that question is no. The problems we're seeing here are not a problem of stupidity. It's not ignorance that leads to these mistakes. Instead, is a system which is queering the problems that are being confronted and the way in which they're being addressed. The influence here, an influence which we all know too well, an influence of money in this process, by which I don't mean bribery, that's not the problem. I mean the process that is driven by lobbyists and by campaign fundraising, which radically affects both access, attention, and understanding around these issues, distorting and weakening the government's ability to actually get it right. Now, there are people who use phraseology like this, the Fox News Channel, some say that, in fact, there's no problem here, that lobbyists, turns out, are good. And not just Fox. Here's a recent clip.
Because you know, a lot of those lobbyists, whether you like it or not, represent real Americans.
Right. Real Americans. Right. Now, of course, it's true lobbyists are essential to the process of making government function. And these people who believe the system's okay as it is, argue that, in fact, lobbyists don't actually change results in particular votes. In fact, what they do is they devote their energy to supporting members who already support the position of the lobbyists. Maybe the best political science article in this space written in the past 20 years by Professor Hall and Deardorff focuses on thinking about lobbying as a kind of legislative subsidy. What the lobbyist does is find the core members who support their views in a strong way and find resources to extend and support and amplify those policymakers, make their policies successful. So the policy choices that the member already has are simply made more effective in this process. And in that sense, the defenders of the system say the system's innocent, it's benign, it's even beneficial by making it easier for the policymaker to advance the ideas the policymaker thinks is important. But this response misses the point in at least two critical ways. Number one, obviously nobody's arguing about whether these are real Americans, these lobbyists, or representing real Americans. I mean, some of them represent non-Americans, of course, but the realness of the Americanness of these represented interests here is not what's at stake. The question is, what is the consequence of this system for representing America? Does it misrepresent America? Does it distort it? And how would it distort it? Well, this is a point that Hall and Deardorff make in their fantastic article. It's about the dynamic that lobbying has on any particular member's choice about which issues he or she will push. So for example, you come to Congress and you say, here are my two big issues. Number one, I want to deal with mothers and welfare. I've got to solve this problem of the way the welfare system deals with mothers. Number two, I'm going to fight piracy. Well, announce yourself like this on day one of your term in Congress. You will have tons of people coming to support you to fight piracy, and not so much to come and help you fight the question of mothers and welfare. So the point is, the system has this distorting effect, not driving Congress people to work on stuff they don't want to work on, but to drive them to work on stuff differently from how they would if they were representing interests that they came to Washington to serve. Now, what's interesting here is it shows the sense in which these are not evil people who are like selling their soul. Oh yeah, I believe in copyright protection, but I'm going to sell out to the free culture movement. We could wish, but okay. That's not what we see going on here. These are good people. Good people working hard to do what they can with extraordinarily limited resources in a system that systematically drives them away from interests which ought to be theirs. So that's the first point that misses. Here's the second point it misses. This argument is oblivious to the question of how we create, how we practice, how the public reads trust in institutions. Think again about Professor Rennie and the examples he's talking about. So for example, there's a drug called Alteplase. It's a drug to deal with what we used to call strokes. The industry now calls it brain attacks. In 1998, the American Health Association funded a study to see whether this drug was any good. Most of the doctors in that study supported the drug. There was an important dissent filed. 2000, when the report was finally published, the dissent disappeared. Indeed, the doctor who wrote it was removed from the list of people who had participated in the study. So it was now a study just about support, wonderful new drug. Then it was discovered by an LA Times reporter that Genentech had given $11 million to the American Health Association, raising important questions about the set of recommendations they had made about a drug from a company that had just given them such a substantial amount of money. And as this LA Times reporter wrote, this recommendation may have been made in the true spirit of unbiased scientific inquiry, but the appearance of dispassionate analysis was eroded by large donations from a drug company. Obviously correct. Well, here's another example, issue about vaccines. Now here you gotta be really careful so you don't think I'm a nut, right? So here first, vaccines are good and right and needed. And number two, mercury does not cause autism. Let me just be very clear about this. Vaccines are good. Mercury does not cause autism, all right? We're clear about that. That's not the point I'm trying to make here. What I'm trying to do is to get you to put yourself in the position, though, of parents whose kids have autism or parents who are afraid of how they're going to raise their young children to avoid autism if indeed it can be avoided, or other diseases or problems caused by taking vaccines. For years, these parents have lived in an extraordinary place of anxiety because of this question of the cause and link between these drugs and the consequence. In a context of pervasive lack of trust in the system that is advising them about what the answer to this scientific question is. And the consequence of this lack of trust is an extraordinary drop-off in the number of parents actually vaccinating their kids. Before 1991, less than 1% of parents opted out of vaccinations. 2004, the number was now 2.5%. And as you know, even a small percentage failing to vaccinate can radically change the spread of drugs, now of disease. Now, why is it parents are doing this? Well, as the House Oversight Committee commented in 2000 about this problem, the FDA standards defining conflicts of interest are ridiculously broad. The CDC has virtually no standards because all, these are committee members on the vaccine committee, members automatically receive annual waivers of conflicts of interest, automatically, allowing in one case a doctor to receive over $250,000 from drug companies whose vaccines he was reviewing on that committee. A process that obviously destroys the ability of people to have trust in this system. And one final example. If you've not seen this extraordinary movie, everybody should. This is a story about the explosion of credit card debt in the United States. It's a story that has many dimensions to it. The most amazing dimension that I saw in it was the role that credit card companies actually have in the creation of this problem. It was a role explained quite dramatically by Harvard's own Elizabeth Warren. She told the story about giving a talk at Citicorp to all the executives about research she had done, building a model to make it possible to predict which credit card applicants would go bankrupt, so that Citicorp could use this model to deny, on the basis of the prediction, of which people couldn't pay credit card applications, as any sort of good-hearted researcher would think, this is progress. We can avoid this problem of people being thrown into bankruptcy or losing the ability to function because of this burden of credit card debt. She describes in the film how at the end of her talk, the lights come up, everybody's quiet in the room, and a man at the back of the room turns out to be one of the senior executives at Citicorp, said to her, "Very interesting, Professor, but if we cut those people off, that's where we make all our profits." She was providing a solution to no problem that Citicorp thought was a problem. In fact, their strategy was to market precisely to these people who would be in a situation of perpetually forced to pay credit card debt. Now, one reason they are perpetually forced to pay this credit card debt is a statute called the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2000. I think it's a typo. It's actually not a Consumer Protection Act at all. The effect of this statute is to make it effectively impossible for a significant class of Americans ever to discharge credit card debts. So in a world where Bethlehem Steel can escape pension obligations or Enron can escape power contract obligations, basically there's no escape from these credit card obligations. You carry them essentially forever. Now this extraordinary bill was first proposed during the administration of Bill Clinton. He was originally in favor of it. And then Professor Warren wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and Hillary Clinton read it and recognized this was an awful bill. And as Professor Warren writes in her book, Hillary Clinton single-handedly kept that bill from becoming law, to her great credit. I didn't actually mean that, but it's kind of cute, yeah. But like Jason in Friday the 13th, this bill just would not go away. So in 2001, it returned, now with a Republican president behind it. By now, of course, First Lady Clinton had become Senator Clinton. And by now, she had received a substantial amount of money from the credit card and financial services industries. So what did she do? Well, this awful bill, she flipped on, voted for the bill, that awful bill, twice. It didn't pass in 2001. 4 years later, she had second thoughts, returned to it again, and this time now, she was firmly against the bill, but actually didn't show up and vote because her husband was having surgery that day. Now, what is it that explains this flip-flop? Hillary Clinton says it's not the money. So she makes this very central.
I don't think, based on my 35 years of fighting for what I believe in, anybody seriously believes I'm going to be influenced by a lobbyist or a particular interest group. Now,
and I actually believe her. I believe this is her character, not to be influenced by money. I don't think that's at all what was going on in this particular bill. But the point that those who think that money is not causing harm miss, the point they're oblivious about, is what do other people think when they hear a story like this? In my district, when I did polling about whether I could run for Congress, we found that 88% of the Democrats in the district believes that money changes outcomes. They're wrong, but that's what they believe. And because they believe this, they have no faith in this government. Now, whether or not it does, even if you, like me, believe Senator Clinton does not make decisions on the basis of money, one thing for sure about all three of these examples is that when money is mentioned in the story, listening stops, thinking stops, trust stops. When you hear money in the story, you assume you know why the result came out as it came out. Talking, or as they say out here in the fancy place of Harvard, dialogue, ends. No more. And the effort at understanding ends. Trust in this process ends because we know why the result is as it was, even when we don't. This is an issue of trust. And the point is to recognize how trust is built by an institution. Even if money has no effect, actually, in getting people to decide one way or the other, the fundamental effect it undoubtedly has is an effect on trust for this institution. Now that extraordinary lack of trust for this institution, whose positives in the latest poll were 19%, that won't change until the role of money changes. And how is it the role of money changes? What sort of changes should there be? Well, in my view, the simplest and obvious change here is public financing of public elections. And there is substantial work by a whole range of people about what exactly this could look like and different solutions that have different advantages. The most prominent right now is a bill in the Senate that will be introduced in the House, introduced by Senator Durbin, which basically follows the model of the two states that have adopted public financing, Maine and Arizona. These states have a two-step process. You basically qualify for public funding by raising a certain number of $5 contributions, and then you get funded. There's no effort in this bill to silence people who want to speak. Of course, the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, wouldn't allow that, but you're free to fund a 527 or anything else you want to talk about a candidate. But if you fund a 527 or if you come in with millions of dollars to talk about a particular candidate, there's a dynamic in the bill to protect against the drowning out from one side or the other. Now, obviously, there's been substantial support on the left for this proposal. But in my view, there should be more support on the right, because there's an insight, a dynamic here that the right has not yet fully grasped. And it's an insight that comes, I think, from a particular story I was told by someone who used to work for the Clinton administration. So in the early days of the Clinton administration, there was a proposal to create Title VII in the Communications Act. Communications Act right now has Titles I through VI. Title II covers public common carriers, in particular telecom, anything to do with telephones. Title VI covers cable. Al Gore's idea was to take Title II and Title VI as it relates to the internet and move it out of Title II and Title VI into something called Title VII, would govern DSL and cable. And Title VII would basically be a deregulated title. So it would be minimal regulations, interconnect, wouldn't have even included what we now call network neutrality. The Gore team took this idea to Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill responded, hell no, as I was told by one of the Gore aides. They were told, how are we going to raise money from the telecom companies if we deregulate them? Right, so the lesson here, which the right's got to recognize, is when they wonder why is government so big, the answer is because congressmen must get elected. And the indirect influence that comes from this need to have the opportunity to call someone whom you're regulating and say, you know, I need money for my campaign, leads in at least some places, and the telecom area, I think most clearly, to much bigger government than would be needed. And what remains here is this dynamic, so long as campaigns are in this sense privately financed. Now the right worries this would be so expensive to run public elections. But as the estimate from the Durbin bill suggests, it's $2 billion in a cycle. And in the context of the federal government's budget, that's tiny. So you can't even see it. It's so tiny. It's a tiny number relative to the effect that this burden on the economy gets produced by this extension of government regulation beyond where it should be. So this change, public financing, would add trust back into the system and remove this dynamic querying the results of particular decisions. If money distorts, if it actually distorts, then public finance would change that directly. So that's one change, number two. But even before we get to this question of change through public finance, we could think about change in a more limited way that would affect the perception, not necessarily the reality, of how people understand what Congress is doing. And here we think about voluntary steps that members could take to promise, to commit to only clean money. They would say, through their commitment, this campaign is different, suggesting to their constituents, the idea, the hope, the dream that politics in this sense could be different. Now, of course, it's not always possible. In certain districts, the contest is too great, and to lay down your arms in this way is to assure that you will be defeated. But the key is to recognize that it is possible in an extraordinary number of districts, because we've architected districts, we've gerrymandered districts to guarantee safe seats in a wide range of contexts. So in those districts we can, again, in my district, members of Congress only left office by dying, not because they were assassinated, but because nobody ever got defeated because it was such a safe seat. So this change, too, would add trust back into the system. And one other change, a change around the problem of, quote, earmarks. There's a perception about earmarks and there's a reality. Sometimes they overlap. But one thing's clear is that there was an explosion in earmarks from the period roughly 1994 to 2006. It dropped off in 2008, but it's not clear where it's going to go afterwards. This explosion imposes a certain cost, no doubt, on the Treasury, but that's not the problem, in my view, with earmarks, not the cost. It's the implicit corruption, the corrosion that it encourages. Because issues that otherwise would have been decided through procedures that are sometimes good, lots of times not very good, but at least procedures that are evaluating the decision according to some standard now get made for the most arbitrary and irrational reasons. So for example, there's a developer, Doug Hoshek, who read that the government needed to find a way to get fire retardant t-shirts for soldiers in Iraq. Because in the context of that war, finding a way to guarantee that the clothes would not melt on your body was an important interest. So the government initially put out a recommendation for a bid, and then magically they decided it would be a no-bid contract. That was because of an earmark placed in the bill by this Democrat from Oregon, giving the contract to this company. A company which made a t-shirt that turned out not actually to be fire retardant, literally melted on the skins of people who used it in fire situations. And then it was discovered this company gave $9,000 directly and indirectly into the campaign of that representative. Now that dynamic is exactly the dynamic that not only creates the lack of trust, but actually makes the system work worse than even this very badly run system would work. So the changes here that I think we need are not obscure, but how is it we could help bring them about? Well, it's with great joy to come back to this place to think about this question. Because, of course, this place has been so central in many of the Netroots campaigns that have been developed over the last decade. These are campaigns that are not DC-centered, meaning the people driving the campaigns are not from inside the Beltway, but they are DC-focused. They're not thinking about abstract questions for just abstract purposes. They're thinking about them to make policy work better. And there's a recognition that outside of this Beltway, people are not quite as insane as they might be inside that Beltway. That was exactly the recognition that led us here to launch the Creative Commons movement. We wanted a way for artists and copyright holders to signal something about what their view was, because we believe most of them were actually not the extremists that Hollywood said they were. And that's the same dynamic we want to enable here. And that's the objective of this movement. We've launched a movement called the Change Congress Movement. Change Congress Movement is to be a bipartisan movement to leverage and amplify reform work that's already being done by others. So think of it as a kind of Google mashup for politics, right? And you can see it literally looks like a Google mashup right now. If you go to our front page, you can see this Google mashup with PAC money and campaigns. And so the darker the sludge color, the more PAC money, the lighter, the less PAC money. You can click on your representative and see exactly how much they're getting. But that's not important or central to what we're doing at all. The more fundamental mashup is developed in these different stages. The first stage we launched on May 20th in Washington, a stage that enables people to pledge their support for reform. And this was a stage that was directly parallel to Creative Commons. Creative Commons wanted a simple way for authors to mark their content with the freedoms they wanted it to carry. So you have a place where you can pick what the freedoms are, and you get a license, and anybody who clicks on that license is given a commons deed that says, here's what you're allowed to do with this creative work, consistent with the wish of the copyright owner. Change Congress wants a simple way for candidates and citizens to signal the reform that they believe in. And the four elements of that reform could be one, promising not to take money from lobbyists or PACs, supported strongly by some Democrats, most prominently John Edwards, and by some Republicans too. Two, promise to permanently ban earmarks, currently strongly supported by the Republicans, a little bit troubling for the Democrats. Three, to support publicly financed public elections, supported strongly by the Democrats and a little bit less by the Republicans. And four, not so strongly by either, supporting commitment to total transparency in the functioning of Congress. So a candidate has the opportunity to come and make the pledge the way you make a pledge in the CC context. You get a badge. The badge gives you code to put on your page. You put it on your page and you click to it, and you're given, like a commons deed, a measure of the commitment that this candidate supports. This one's totally hypothetical at this moment. And a citizen, too, has the opportunity to make a pledge about what kind of reform they want and put that on their page and then signal through that badge exactly the support they would support. That's layer one. Layer two, which just went live about 20 minutes ago, is technology to enable Wikified-like tools to encourage an army of collaborators to effectively suss out which candidates or members are for reform, and then verify that, and where they're not for reform, to ask them to. So the very first version of this looks something like this. Have this opportunity to track politicians according to the pledges. You could enter your zip code, and then you're given the candidates in that zip code, then you can pick on a particular candidate. She's a candidate in the 12th district where I was going to run. And then you click on this, and you're given the chance to add information about where this candidate stands on particular issues. You've got to quote the candidate in the candidate's own words. And then you've got to provide a citation that can be verified. And then once it's verified by change organizers, volunteers that we're beginning to gather, then it's represented, this is what you stand for. So the first member who joined, who in fact is here tonight and will be talking to you a little bit later, Congressman Jim Cooper from the 5th District of Tennessee, has taken pledges, and this is the pledges that he's taken, and it stands on his webpage, yet to be verified by our administrators, but I trust the congressman when he tells me. Now, the idea here is, once we've gone out and verified the positions of all the candidates, we're going to build a map. And the map will be a map of actual pledges and actual support of members of Congress. So if, as a member, like Congressman Cooper, you have taken a pledge, then you'll get either a dark blue or a dark red mark on your district. If you have taken positions consistent with the pledge, once we've sussed this out, you'll get a light red or a light blue mark on the district. And if you've neither taken a pledge or taken positions consistent with the pledge, then you'll get a kind of sludgy brown, depending on the amount of clean money in your district. And so then the map will look something like this. And what we think it will reveal is something that's not clear and easy to see right now, which is the deep and strong commitment there is to change both of the blues and of the reds, to the fact that the commitment to change is actually, when understood in this way, broad and deep. And then layer three begins to help fund this reform, kind of carrot in this process, following Emily's List model, to aim for people who want to fund reform by supporting reform. You go and you say, I'm willing to give $10 a month to five candidates who support my picture of reform, and we watch what you've committed to, and we map it to candidates who, in fact, have made the same commitments, to fund this support for these campaigns for reform. Now, all three of these stages build on an important recognition. You call it the web way or Silicon Valley way, or I call it the kind of Berkman way to think about how we're going to make this work. It's a way that Wikipedia has demonstrated most successfully. That way is to take the problem, as Yochai Benkler's amazing book describes it, the problem you're trying to solve and break it up into manageable, digestible, segmentable components, the sort of thing that someone can do for 20 minutes a week in their pajamas. And then give them a big idea which their work helps serve, so that after 20 minutes they feel like they've done something important. And that combination of the tools to enable them to do the work and a big public idea drives an extraordinary range of workers to produce something valuable, complementing, we believe, the extraordinary work being done by organizations out there driving for reform right now. Of course, there's no new ideas in what we're pushing and substance of the reform. There is just a new opportunity. And it's that opportunity the Change Congress movement wants to leverage. An opportunity in this five-year period where Congress doesn't quite understand the web yet. And we understand it enough that we can architect it to develop the power necessary to actually affect change. These are the first steps. And the first steps plus 1 week is that we can announce today that on the Clout radio show on Air America, every single week there will be an update of Change Congress where we talk to the latest people to pledge and the latest people to fight to get people to pledge to make this a regular part of what people hear on this show. And of course, as I've announced, and you will hear from, we get to announce today the commitment of our first member, a man who's spent an extraordinary amount of time with me explaining to me how this system now doesn't work, and from whom I've learned a great deal. And he was the first person I asked to join this movement because in some way I feel he's inspired this work in me. But then we have a number of important next steps. Most important is to recruit this army of web workers, wiki workers, and especially geeks. All of them citizens here, right? Basically you is the people we're talking about, who will take these ideas and make this actually work through the work it takes to make it succeed. Because the one thing we know is that only if the outside makes a demand will the inside of this system change. That's the argument. Let me end with one more thought. So the framers of our Constitution were obsessed with independence, by which I don't mean independence from England. They'd gotten that after the War of 1776. I mean independence in the sense of a lack of dependence, a lack of a process by which members, both citizens and members of government, depended upon another. As Eric Foner describes, it was the axiom of 18th century political thought that dependents lacked a will of their own and thus did not deserve a role in public affairs. Or as Jefferson put it, dependence begets subservience and venality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares fit tools for the designs of ambitions. They wanted members in Congress who could exercise their judgment about what was right without a fear of consequence in at least an improper way, an improper dependence, which for them focused on money, money in the traditional corrupt sense of bribery. But the common aim of the institutions that they were building was to build constitutions against that dependence. Now the reality is the idealism of our framers failed in the framers' own period. Here's a picture of Daniel Webster, really ugly picture, but that's the point because the story is pretty ugly. As a member of Congress, Webster was also a lobbyist for the Bank of the United States, the very entity he was regulating. And in one very famous letter, he wrote to the bank, "If it be wished that my relation to the bank be continued, it may be well to send me the usual retainers." Idealism notwithstanding, the reality was the system was pervaded by this form of corruption. Indeed, bribery was not even illegal in Congress until 1853. Now, this reality led Thomas Jefferson, before the Republic was founded, but still knowing the character of the Republic he knew in Virginia, to believe that indeed we would never solve this problem. As he wrote in his notes in Virginia, we should look forward to a time, and that's not a distant one, when corruption in this, as in the country from which we derive our origin, will have seized the heads of government and be spread by them through the body of the people, when they will purchase the voices of the people and make them pay the price. Now, Jefferson's insight was richer and more accurate than Ronald Reagan's, but directly connected to Ronald Reagan's. Because Reagan, too, was fearful of the dynamic that democracy creates that leads to its collapse, the same dynamic. But the thing that Ronald Reagan missed was that it's not the poor who are raping our country. It's not that they've gathered together and found ways to bleed the treasury of the money. It's the inheritors of the Reagan Revolution. It's the rich who have found ways to use power to capture government to succeed in this corruption directly. This is not a problem of wealth being pumped down. It's the reverse. It's a problem of wealth being pumped up as the top 1% take this power to exercise control over government to protect themselves, costing the bottom 90%, the rest. And indeed, it's the top 1%. It's us who do nothing as this happens. Now, this dynamic is profoundly destructive of trust, profoundly destructive of democracy. It is indeed the most difficult political problem perhaps we face, even harder than this one, freeing Mickey. And until we change this, this problem won't go away. Now, if you talk to experts, political experts, as I did when I thought about running for Congress, about this issue and whether you could make this the center of any campaign, they say it's impossible to win elections on the basis of this issue. Ordinary people never focus, will never be concerned with process issues. They only care about substance. But in this skepticism, the experts forget extraordinarily important moments in the history of America which were progressive revolutions, post-Watergate. The progressives themselves, and the founding period, were all periods where process was the center of the reform. And in this skepticism by the experts, they fail to see something that I suggest all of us know intimately. All of us know this kind of problem. So everybody in this room knows or has been hurt by an alcoholic. I have. My family's been torn apart by alcoholism. And when you know an alcoholic and you look at his life, you know that he's losing many important things, the most important problems he faces. He could be losing his family, his job, and his liver. And these are, of course, the critical problems he needs to solve. But what we know about alcoholism is he will not solve any of these problems until he solves the alcoholism first. And so too with this problem confronting our government. It's not that it's the most important problem out there. It's just the first problem that we have to solve. There's no end to problems that face the United States right now, extraordinarily significant problems from global warming, even down to the free culture movement. These are extremely important problems, but we won't address them sensibly until we deal with this first problem first, until we change, not in this abstract and hopeful way that will launch someone perhaps to a presidency, not till we change in this sense, but until we change Congress. Now, all of my close friends look at me launching this movement and they say, this is fantastic, it's wonderful, we're so happy for you, but you know you're going to fail in this. But the part that I remind them of is the extraordinary lesson that failure teaches, indeed the inspiration that failure teaches. Even certain failure teaches. Because certain failure is just no excuse not to do something about the most important first problem facing us right now. And it's especially no excuse for us. We, the most wealthy, secure, and articulate people in this polity, we first must solve this problem. And if not us, then who? Because the most outrageous part of this story is that these corruptions I'm describing are primed by the most privileged within this society. And they are permitted by the passivity of the rest of us who are privileged in the society. So I'm honored to be back here celebrating the 10th anniversary of Berkman, asking you to join me here, to join us in this process, perhaps hopeless, but nonetheless extraordinarily important process to try to change Congress. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. I'm eager to take your questions and abuse, but I'm also extremely eager to introduce to you an extraordinary man and a graduate from an extraordinary institution. I'm allowed to say that as long as I don't mention the name, I'm told by my dean, but a graduate of an extraordinary law school. And a person who has done something that will be very hard for other members to do, which is to take the lead in this. We're going to have a lot of challengers who step up and say they're happy to take this pledge. But the hardest thing is for people in this system to identify themselves with a fundamental change in the system. So I was extraordinarily honored that it took less than 1 hour after I sent my email for Congressman Jim Cooper to respond with, "Of course, I will join you." So let me welcome Jim Cooper up here and invite him to talk to you.
That was not only a brilliant lecture Larry gave, I think you have witnessed an important moment in American history. And I would like for it very much to start in this famous old courtroom here. The answer to the question, though, really lies with you, your friends here and all over the country, whether you care enough to make a difference. In my opinion, and I've been in and around Congress for almost a quarter of a century, I was the youngest congressman in America. Sadly, that's no longer true. But it is hopelessly broken. We really, really need change now. I don't know how political I can be. I'm for Barack Obama. But, you know, whatever policy or politician you're for, we've got to make change happen. This is government of the people, by the people, for the people, and most people are checked out, don't care, apathetic, indifferent, don't understand. This was a very nuanced and sophisticated presentation that Larry gave. There is so much more to come with Larry and with this movement. I'm just thankful that a professor of this magnitude has chosen to risk his career and his reputation by doing the right thing for the country. I hope you will take a similar risk. So So I'm not a typical politician. I don't make long speeches. I'm done. Thanks for letting me be here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I'm happy to answer any questions or anything else. Or we can go drink, which I understand is also on the table. Yeah, back here.
Please come to the mic if you'll identify yourself and speak to the record.
So while he's coming, why don't we start here?
Okay. Mark Elsie, Harvard Extension School. During your talk, you talked about the clean election laws that they have in Arizona and in Maine. As I'm sure you know, here in Massachusetts, we had passed a similar law, which ultimately failed because our state legislature declined to fund it, and so it never really went into effect. I was wondering, what lessons do you think we can take from that failure and how we can avoid that outcome in the future?
Yeah, so it's not surprising that the incumbents don't want this kind of change. Interestingly, the public financing campaign is trying to convince incumbents that, in fact, it doesn't actually destroy the power of incumbency. So in Maine and Arizona, you haven't seen a substantial drop in return of incumbents in office. And that's a way to try to encourage the incumbents to recognize why this kind of change could be so valuable. Now, frankly, I'm baffled by the unwillingness of members to think about this. I mean, because on the one hand, you know, the reality of being a member of Congress, and this will be the freshest Congress in a decade, so at least 68 new members are going to discover this on day one, is that you live this life up on Capitol Hill, which includes 2 to 4 hours a day scurrying off to a tiny little office outside of your office in some townhouse and becoming a telemarketer as you sit there and call people to raise money for your campaign. You do this constantly. This is your life. And as I looked at that life and I thought about, my God, what would this life be if I, in fact, was a member of Congress, I wondered, why does anybody put up with it? Right? Because it's extraordinary. You know, they go to Congress thinking what they're going to do is think about what the right answer is, and they spend all their time as a telemarketer. And they're not even paid as much as really good telemarketers are. Now, I think the answer that comes back when you frame that is that members think, well, it's a terrible life, but at least I've figured out how to succeed in it. So if I give this up, then somebody else can defeat me. And members tend to over or exaggerate the risk to their seat relative to what the actual risk is. And so I think that means the only way we can get them to do this is to, from the outside, push them hard. You know, inspire them and get them to stand up and stand for ideas, but that they respond to interests just like everybody else does. So that's what this movement's trying to do, to raise the interest. Now, I'd love somebody to replicate Change Congress and to change the Massachusetts legislature. That would be great. You know, it's CC licensed, so you can do whatever you want with it. But it's because we need this, obviously, at every level. But I think what's really important is to show people how we can succeed at this critical level. And once we do, I think it'll be much easier in every other state.
Thanks. This microphone seems to be circulating in the audience. First of all, I was struck by, at least at a distance, how you seem to suddenly go from being a candidate to launching this project. And is that just a misperception on my part because I'm so far removed? Was this something you were developing? I'm specifically interested in how you came to make the decision to seemingly suddenly drop your campaign. I must say, I'm tempted to think somebody came along and said, here's an awful lot of money to help you do this other thing. Wouldn't you rather do this? I'm not suggesting that that's what happened, but I know people for whom that has happened. And then secondly, have you thought about, I missed the very beginning of your talk, but have you thought about ways in which this can be geographically grounded in congressional districts, and how might that part of something like this take shape?
Yeah. So, nobody tried to buy me out. You know, my whole career fighting copyright issues, I was always eager for that moment where, you know, the MPA came and said, we'll give you millions of dollars to stop, but they never did. So,
But in fact, what happened here was the reverse. So I gave what was billed my last free culture lecture at Stanford in January, just after Tom Lantos had announced he wasn't running. And in that lecture, I outlined Change Congress. And after that lecture, a bunch of people said to me, okay, why don't you come out of the ivory tower and actually do what you say ought to happen? Why don't you run for Congress? Here's an open seat. Happens once a generation. So run for Congress. And then a bunch of people out here launched this thing called the Draft Lessig movement in Facebook, and extraordinary number of people joined right away and raised a whole bunch of money. And I said, about a week after they launched that, okay, I would, you know, due diligence, look at it. And so what happened was I had great support. For example, Joe Trippi, who was running the Edwards campaign, left the Edwards campaign because that was over and came to California, and we sat down and worked out whether this was possible. We hired the best pollsters we could to figure out whether it was possible. And what we found was the issue was salient in our district. Like, people got it, and they were really angry about it. But we were also running against Mother Teresa. I mean, she is the most popular, and, you know, I voted for her as a state senator. She's the most popular state senator, and she was an assemblywoman before that. She was an aide to Congressman Ryan when Congressman Ryan was shot when he went over to Africa in the Jim Jones massacre, and she was shot 5 times and lay on the tarmac for the whole afternoon, I think 6 or 7 hours. You know, so she's a hero, and she was the point was, we needed to make a story about corruption in Congress, and however we could point to her taking money or whatever, it was not going to work against her. There was just no way that we could work against her, because by this time, Congressman Lantos had died, and so there was a special election. A special election would be held next Tuesday. So there was about 40 days between where we were and the election. So I just recognized, if Joe Trippi says it can't be done, it can't be done. because, you know, a man who takes Howard Dean and tries to make John Edwards president, he's not somebody who shies away from risks, but he said it couldn't be done. So I was confident, because of the support, especially the support launched out here, we could do the traditional thing, which is raise all the money in the world, but we couldn't deliver a message that wouldn't actually produce a backfire so if you had a year or had more time, it would have been different. So the geographic part, that's the really important part. So the way this second stage works, and we're just at the very beginning of releasing it now, but the way the second stage works is that you imagine people in each district tagging their own member, and then, you know, having a kind of life as members in the district, tracking what their member does as their member votes or doesn't vote for the issues that they've made a pledge to. So the idea is to enable in each district these communities, and already we've begun to create a relationship with Meetup to facilitate that physical and virtual connection in each of the districts around the country. But, you know, our idea is to have 1,000, 10,000, you tell me how many is needed, people in this project spread across the country geographically working on this issue in the way that, you know, Wikipedia gets worked on, but very much focused on geographically located struggles.
Joshua Gay, I guess, League of Technical Voters is who I'll represent today.
Hi, Joshua.
Hi. So in your first point on response to what misses the point, you know, you stress that our legislators are good people and that they lack resources is one of the things that they lack. I agree with that. I think that they have good hearts. I'm a geek, one of the few who actually does care about these things. There are a couple of us out there. You can quickly find them all. and a couple years ago, I was interested in this question of how do we help legislators? As a geek, I look at things very systematically, and I said, okay, what do legislators do? They help get bills written, and then they pass them. So I was like, oh, okay, so legislation is what they do. So I looked into legislation and learned about it, and I was like, okay, well, we need to help facilitate this process because it's hard. And the first thing I started doing, both calling legislative aides, calling the Library of Congress, sort of their librarians at the Senate Library as well, and other people who help facilitate this process of moving legislation out to the public, The first thing I learned was that legislators don't read the bills. And I was like, wait a second, I have to pass these, but I don't read them. And it was a big stumbling block, and it was really disheartening when I learned that. I was like, how are these good people if their only job is to read the bills and pass them? And then I learned a little bit more. You know, it's not that simple. And one of the biggest challenges we have, I think, is to be able to help all of these aides and these legislators help them read the bills. It really takes everybody's efforts. As you said, you know, the lobbyists understand one section of these bills. Other people understand other sections. But all of us, in aggregate, you know, can help understand different parts of them. I see you as a leader of helping build these movements, of helping directing people toward that. How do you see your role and Change Congress's role in helping to bridge that gap between the geeks, the lawyers, and then everybody else who doesn't know they can help this process, who are an expert at something, whether it's education or healthcare, from some level?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm happy to try to push this along, and that's what I'm going to be doing. But I think the biggest thing that's needed is that a whole bunch of people take the lead. So you've been doing a ton of work in this space, obviously, and other people too. So obviously there's a lot already, people who are real geeks doing great work. But I think what would make it successful is if we had some clear victories. You know, they might come after some pretty devastating defeats, but you know, eventually we'll get some clear victories. And I actually think we're close with a bunch of these issues that we're focusing on Change Congress. So the first thing I'd say is help us here. And if you can get this distorting influence out of Congress and allow Congress to focus on what they're there to do, they're going to be much more interested in projects like the one you're describing that help them understand what the nuances in the bill is. And, you know, this is the one of the things that sort of hit me when I began to think about this issue. You know, people, I'm a constitutional law professor at Stanford, spend my whole life criticizing the Supreme Court. I can give you 1,000 reasons why every decision of the Supreme Court is wrong. But the one thing which is absolutely true is that never does it enter my head, or I think anybody credible, that what the court is doing is deciding questions for this kind of illicit, corrupting reason, because of their own money or money for their institution or anything like that. It's just not there, because they've done such a good job at creating an institution that protects from that. State courts, not so true, but federal courts and the Supreme Court in particular, very true. We complain because they have an improper dependence with politics, but they don't have an improper dependence on money. Now, the one extraordinary experience about, you know, having an opportunity to work in institutions like courts, and I clerk at this court, and I clerked at the Supreme Court for Justice Scalia, who hired me knowing I was a liberal and he was a conservative, and hid that fact from his clerks until the very last minute, the fact that he had hired me because he knew they would have all quit or something like that. The one really amazing experience, part of that experience, was having the opportunity in contexts that weren't political, you know, political cases, to actually have an argument where the argument was advancing reasons that led the justice to do one thing or the other. There was it's like that's what we were there for, to argue. And the most striking contrast between talking to judges and talking to members in Congress is that they play at argument, right? They pretend that's what they're doing. And if you continue to push them, at a certain point, they're like, don't you get it? This is just a game. we're just pretending to be arguing here. We're not really arguing. So like you launch some really powerful, devastating move that actually shows what they said is wrong, and like you've done something unfair. Like what you're supposed to be is polite, and polite means, you know, having a conversation that says, yeah, well, you know, the deficit or terrorism, you know, and make those moves at that level, as opposed to, and part of the reason for that is, in some sense, everybody knows, you know, the game is not always really about what's the right answer. It's also about, I can't afford that answer. I can't afford that answer because I can't afford to alienate this extraordinary chunk of money that isn't part of my life. So if we could pull that back, then the thing I want congressmen to recognize is they could have a really great job, like the best possible job. They could just sit there and figure out you know, they got to listen to their voters. That's an appropriate dependency. But they can just figure out what the right answer is. And, you know, they can take advice from people like you or people like Harvard Law School or all sorts of people giving them great advice and do the right thing. Like, why wouldn't you want that job? Like, they've been elected to it. Why don't they just take it? And all they'd have to do to take it is to pass one bill right now, right? A bill that's introduced. Somebody's written it. It's really long, so it's done. But nobody's read it, I'm sure. But it's done. And so this is the puzzling thing to me. And it's just getting them to recognize this and pushing them to recognize this. So geeks and people who have technical capacity to leverage this network into something powerful, devote it to this. You know, not to my movement. I you know, eagerly want this movement to not be my movement quickly, because if it's my movement, it fails. You know, it can't be about a person. It's about, you know, who, you know, Jimmy Wales is Wikipedia, but he's not Wikipedia, right? It's not about Jimmy Wales. It's about the thousands who have built that place, and that's the same thing that's got to happen here. And I eagerly need people to step forward and do it, and I'll step back quickly so that it is that movement of the outside trying to, you know, give the congressman the job they wanted.
Thank you.
Hi.
My name's Shava Nirad, and until 1997, I was a geek, and then I was working at the Eugene Freenet, and the federal government came in and said, you can't be a nonprofit, you're giving internet service to poor people, and internet service is not necessary, education or charitable work. So, you know, no more nonprofit internet. So I stopped being quite so much of a geek and I became a lobbyist. And one thing that I see as a missing piece out of this that I'd like you and the people who are working on this to consider is to create a pledge for lobbying organizations.
It's a great idea, wow.
Because I was a lobbyist who went to DC on my own dime and spent weeks in DC going and shutting down the Library of Congress Law Library when I was not a lawyer, and spending, you know, begging to get a half an hour with Leahy's judiciary advisor, and going around and talking to the NTIA and things like that with no knowledge of what I was doing, but I actually managed to have an influence because we have a right to petition our government, and if you give people good information, they can make better decisions. And that's an important part of lobbying that gets lost in this perception of corruption.
Yeah.
So if you go to people who are doing lobbying in Congress and you say, your organization pledges not to give contributions to legislators they're lobbying, and your organization pledges to give nothing but information, and so on and so forth, then you could actually improve it from the other side also.
Yeah, so first I hate to break it to you, but somebody who wears a Tor t-shirt is a geek, okay?
You know, geeks. No. I just did their grant writing.
Okay. I think it's a fantastic idea, and I think, it connects to the bigger point that I'm trying to make in this. That, you know, I think there's an enormous amount of respect that lobbyists deserve. You know, not criminal lobbyists, but most lobbyists. I mean, these are very intelligent, hardworking people. Who do their job extremely well, right? And they are essential, I think, to giving information to Congress in ways that Congress needs. So it's not a criticism of lobbyists, but you know, again, think back to the lawyer model. There are great lawyers that argue before the Supreme Court, right? It's just there's no reason why they then should have the power to give Justice Scalia a $2,000 contribution after arguing before the Supreme Court, right? It's that additional step that begins to change the way the system functions. So I'd love the world of Congress where Congress doesn't need to worry about that kind of money coming in order to get elected, and then they listen to lobbyists who help them in all sorts of ways. There will be a skew in the way that I described. You know, it'll still be Hollywood's lobbies that are more effective than changing problems with welfare from others, no doubt. Just like in the Supreme Court, you've got Munger, Tolson, Olson arguing a case in the Supreme Court. It's really great. And then you have some guy from Mississippi who's never argued a case, or a law professor from Harvard who's never argued a case in the Supreme Court. And, you know, the reality is some are good and some are bad. So that's the way lobbyism will be as well. But I agree. This is not about evil lobbyists, not about evil members of Congress. It's about systems. And until we start getting people to recognize that you can have good people in a bad system, you can even have good Germans, right? That's what we have to think about. That's the metaphor, and fix the institution so that we don't have that metaphor.
Larry, are you okay with two more?
Sure.
Okay, please.
Hi, my name is Roman Zadoff, and I was wondering how you're going to take this organization you're making and protect it from abuse and give a trust in, you know, in the way you're trying to make.
Boy, great question. Really great question. Yeah, well, I don't know. That's the part that's got to be built too. You know, what we've been frantically doing with tiny resources is pulling together infrastructure to get it going. We haven't even put together the board yet. We haven't put together what the structure of the organization looks like yet. And these are the million questions that, you know, have got to be part of it. I agree. Because, you know, in one sense, when we launched Change Congress, the vision was that these pledges, you know, that you could make wouldn't necessarily have to be permanent. Like, you know, what if they solve the problem of public financing? You know, great, fantastic. But it's not like there aren't other issues to worry about. Like, for example, gerrymandering. It's ridiculous that Congress is architected so that huge number of seats are totally saved. I understand why it happened. It actually happened for a good reason, to protect minority districts, right? But, you know, there's a lot of issues here that we could continue to worry about. And maybe Change Congress moves on to these issues as others become more important. But these are a bunch of questions that, in some sense, the organization has to decide when the organization comes to life. So here I am asking it to come to life. And then we'll have to figure those out. But you're signed up. I got you.
I'll send you an email. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So last question.
Hi. Howard Melman. If I could sum up the bribery versus trust issue as perception is reality, did I understand you right that you wanted to aggregate donations from citizens to candidates? And if that, isn't that rather PAC-like? And doesn't that make it an issue for the first pledge?
Yeah, so this is a big issue that, in fact, we hit when I was considering running for Congress, because I said I would take the pledge, no PAC money, and all the money was coming, being aggregated or collected by Act Blue, which is technically a PAC, right? So Act Blue sets up web pages, and the draft Lessig had a web page, and Lessig 08 had a web page, and you gave money to Act Blue, and then Act Blue gave money to the candidate. Now, there are two reasons why, in the end, I didn't think that was an issue. One reason is technical. The Federal Elections Commission had ruled that any contribution through Act Blue would be deemed as a contribution from the person, not from Act Blue. So it's, you know, if you gave me $2,000 in the campaign, it would be you, not Act Blue, that gave me $2,000. But the second is, the point is to look at why one might be concerned about PACs. And it's that the PACT is an aggregation that's non-transparent. So if Act Blue gathers together, you know, 1,000 people who give $100 to somebody and then channel it to that person, it's totally transparent what that is. It's just a, you know, it's PayPal. It's like PayPal. It's just a funding mechanism. And that transparency, I think, is the critical part. The problem that I think, you know, exists with PACs, and again, I don't have any real, you could be really ambiguous about the PAC issue, because a lot of PACs were started for good reason. They aggregate in the context of, you know, union PACs, where you're talking about people making tiny amounts of money. What else are they going to do? They don't have a PayPal account, right? So there's, I'm not saying it's clear about PACs, but the point is, to the extent there is a problem, the problem is that you have this amplified influence. This one entity has this amplified influence, and that's the dynamic that you know, we need to mitigate if you want to have a view about clean money. You need a world where I as a congressman have to convince 30,000 people to support me in order to get elected. That's the world you want. Just like, you know, Jim has come out of the closet about, well, he's never been in the closet about Barack Obama, but I come out of the closet about Barack Obama too. He and I were colleagues at Chicago. He actually was a professor at Chicago, contrary to the rumors out there. You know, so the amazing thing is public financing the way Barack Obama has succeeded in this campaign, like thousands of people giving, you know, money, a million people giving him money, right? So as long as it's that dynamic that the candidate faces, like how do I convince 30,000 people to support me, I'm okay with it. If they support me by giving money to ActBlue and then ActBlue gives the money to me, I'm not troubled by it. What I'm troubled by is a world where I know that there are just 500 people I need to talk to, and those 500 people have connections, not just from PACs, but also bundling money and all these other ways in which they have connections to make it so I don't have to worry about 30,000, only 500. That's the dynamic that clean money tries to get rid of.
I understand it's a slippery slope argument, but of course, the first pledge is not ambiguous about PACs.
That's right, it's not. Yeah, don't accept money from PACs. Although, yeah, the way the pledges work is not that we're going to enforce the pledge. People have to ask the question whether the member has actually lived up to the pledge. You know, so then the argument is, have you taken money from a PAC in the sense in which they take it? So when I had to answer this on my blog as I was considering running for Congress, I sort of articulated why I don't think it's a problem taking money from ActBlue, even though I promised not to take money from the AFL-CIO or Microsoft. Oh, well, that's not a problem, but other companies like that. So I'm really, it's extraordinarily great to see people here, and I feel such warmth, obviously, always being back at Harvard, and thank you. Thank you, John.
So please join me in thanking and welcoming back home to his second home, Lawrence Lessig, and joining us downstairs after this. Thank you.